Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready for more propaganda? Well, you're in the wrong place at the right time. Columbo Chronicles is for critical thinkers. Let's welcome the consumer advocate for justice. Here's the Rose, Rose Columbo.
Hi, everyone. It's the Rose, Rose Columbo, right here for you at the Justice Club and at the Columbo Chronicles, where you're going to hear a very special author and expert. So don't touch that dial.
The Justice Club is back on Columbo Chronicles live podcast. Join Rose Columbo at noon and find out what tips she will provide in a world of little justice.
That's right. You're going to find out what little justice there is on part two. But on part one, we're going to enter into the world of authors and experts, which is self-help for those who are wannabe writers or are professional writers, want to improve their writing, want to know what's the latest, and what our guest is up to, Sarita Stevens, who is a return guest and an award-winning writer and producer. She is an exciting person because she does not sit still. She has a long list of books and scripts and treatments and all sorts of TV and film accomplishments and achievements. And I'm going to tell you just a little more about her when we come back right after this important message. Hey, so don't touch that dial.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Hi, everyone. I hope everybody's doing great and planning for the holiday season. We've got Halloween, we've got Thanksgiving, we got Christmas and New Year's and Valentine's. Lots of good things that are positive coming to us in the near future that we can plan for. And I want to give out a positive feeling out there that we can still, despite everything that's going on around us, block it out and enjoy whatever we're doing, whether it's a hobby, whether it's a profession, whether it's a new career, an education. We'll embrace it and we'll be grateful for it, and especially for our health, because as I tell everyone, health is wealth, and a sound mind is worth no amount of money. Right? Right. So on that note, with a sound mind, hopefully, and with a lot of energy here from our guest, let me introduce her to you. We are going to enter into the world of authors and experts with returning dynamic guest, Sarita Stevens. She's fabulous. She is an award-winning writer-producer. She was born in Chicago. I visited Chicago a couple of times and really enjoyed it with my friends and then my kids, and boy, we had a good time. And let's get back to our wonderful guest. She was born in Chicago, and her name is Sarita Stevens. That's S-T-E-V, like Victor, E-N-S. And she is a registered nurse who came out to Los Angeles, teaching job at USC. And with her master's degree in writing, with honors from Antioch University in London, England. She went on to become a well-known writer in the romance and mystery field. Working as an investigative reporter for CBS Chicago, that's an exciting job, she helped discover a hospital in the northern suburb who pretended to heal cancer patients with their falsified alternative methods. And she didn't stop there. She created a series, in fact, and for television and created what is she calls forensic nurses. So let's get started and talk to her more about what she's up to today and also what are her new projects, and maybe she'll offer us some wonderful tips. Hi, Sarita Stevens. How are you doing today?
Hi there, Rose. How are you? Are you keeping cool, I hope? It's so hot out. My gosh.
Well, I'm like maybe 15 minutes away from the ocean, so we get the ocean breeze, so it doesn't get as hot
nice.
Here as it gets down there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and you get spoiled, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah. So what is the temperature there?
I think
it's only
74
here.
This morning when I got into my car.
Holy smokes.
We're up in the valley, so.
Yeah. You got to come down here and visit.
Yeah, really.
Cool air.
Mm.
So, Sarita, you have such a magnificent background in the field of writing and investigative reporting. And so why don't you tell our audience some of the important things you think are they would like to hear about your background?
Well, sure. I grew up on a series called Cherry Ames. And people like Nancy Drew, right, and older people might remember, it was Cherry Ames student nurse, Cherry Ames senior nurse, Cherry Ames cruise nurse, et cetera. And Cherry Ames was solving crimes while she was nursing. And that's what I wanted to do, of course. And when I got to nursing school, it wasn't anything like that. Until I met a friend who had a handle, Sleuth RN. And then I found out about forensic nursing, which is a newish field started by some ER nurses who realized that rape victims were not getting proper care and people were ignoring the emotional aspect and just looking at the physical aspect. And then we expanded into working with domestic violence. I work a lot with domestic violence victims now, with legal nurse consulting. I'm an expert witness for the courts in psychiatric cases, in elder abuse, child abuse, arson, motor vehicle accidents, workman's comp, psychiatric problems, and death investigation. So one of my books is called The Forensic Nurses. It's how law enforcement's secret weapon. And I created a series for a scripted series, which has been optioned and is making the rounds right now. And hopefully it will be out soon about how we as nurses help police solve crimes, because most nurses do not know how to collect evidence or how to testify in court. Actually, most doctors don't know either. It's a fascinating field, and I felt that I had an obligation to educate people as well as entertain them. So that's one of the things I have going. And I just had a book published called Logan's Land, which is a Western romantic suspense from a female viewpoint. Not many Westerns are told from a female viewpoint, unless you talk about maybe Annie Oakley.
I remember Annie Oakley, and it was a really exciting time to watch Westerns, you know, in the past. And I still love Westerns. I love when they make Westerns. So tell me then, do you think that Westerns are coming back?
Everything has a cycle. And, yes, they will come back. I don't know when. I think maybe they're edging on and starting to come back now. But what happens is that the producers and the publishers start getting inundated with people wanting to write Westerns or Gothics or whatever, and they don't do the research, they do the tropes, and they don't do it right. And so then people stop buying them and they get bored, and so the publishers and producers stop using them. And then it takes a while for people to want them again. It's sort of like vampires. Vampires are coming back now, too. You know, they were...
In more ways
you know,
than one.
Yeah, that's true.
They'll
that's
be here
true.
For Halloween, for sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But even as kids, though, we like to watch those vampire movies. You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they were so fascinating. They go way back to the classics. So you think Westerns and vampire movies are going to make a comeback?
Oh, I think they will. Actually, I adopted my daughter from Romania when she was an infant. And I tell my friends, she's a direct descendant of Vlad. You know, Vlad Tepes was the original Dracula because of like garlic on a pizza. So I recreated a story about Dracula coming back through DNA. And that's another one that's making the rounds right now. So
you are very, very busy. So tell us more about Logan's Land.
Okay, so Logan's Land, as I said, it's an unusual one because it's from a female viewpoint. And in this story, a young woman, it's 1890s, is in Chicago and having trouble. She's an orphan and goes out to Montana to find her twin brother, who she hasn't heard from. And she finds out he's dead. And she decides that the killer is the last person he worked for, Logan James. And Logan wants her to, and Logan is one of the robber barons that owns a lot of the land in that area. And people have been frightening the smaller farmers off the land and buying the land up. And she's sure that he killed her brother. And she's determined to find out and see justice. And he wants her to come out there to be with him and teach his daughter. And she doesn't want to. Finally, she agrees that she will come out only on the condition that he marries her platonically in name only. And while she's out there, she starts investigating and realizes that something else is going on, helps the Indians out there and finds out the Indians are being scammed. It turns out she starts falling in love with Logan. And after he's shot, she realizes somebody's after her as well. And I won't tell the ending, but it's an exciting ending. It's won several awards, and it has been optioned several times already as a feature. So hopefully that'll come out too pretty soon. But that's
so
available for A&K Books right now.
So when you're telling our audience it's an option, you want to explain what you mean by that?
Okay,
an option
means an option means that I wrote a script version of it. And producers have taken it up and paid me, these days options don't pay very little at all, maybe a dollar if you're lucky, but you used to pay a lot more. They take it around and try and sell it to a network or to a theater or to produce it themselves. And so that's, and they try to get the money to develop the movie and to produce the movie. So that's basically an option agreement, which is different from a shopping agreement, which usually doesn't pay anything at all, but also means that they have the exclusive right to take it around. So you have to be careful what you are signing when you look at these things.
Yeah, I would think so. And so, because you'd be giving up your rights, right?
Yes.
You're not careful.
Well, you're not giving them up. You're putting your rights on hold while they start taking it around, you know. But get everything in writing. My husband always makes sure that I get everything in writing, and you have to have a lawyer looking over it. Just, you know, you think you know things, but there's a lot of times they can sneak things words in that mean things, and you don't understand what's going on.
Yeah, that happened to me with my first book. It definitely happened to me. It was an experience that I don't want to go through again.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, because I agree with you. You have to have, if you're going to get someone shopping your book around, that's very important.
Well, most of it, especially if you're working with a friend or somebody that you know and think is trustworthy, you think it's okay, that verbal things are okay, but the fact is that people hear different things, and when it comes to money, people interpret things a lot different than you might interpret things. So everything needs to be in writing, even if it's your best friend that you're writing with.
Thank you for that, because that is so important, because we all want to trust. Most people are good people. They really want to trust people. I want to trust their family, their friends, whoever it is. And there's some slick talking guy. And the thing is that it's so sad when they rip them off, you know, rip off people.
Yeah.
And it happens all the time in Hollywood. I mean, that's a no one.
It does.
So
it does.
Yeah, it does. I've been ripped off with things I suggested, and I found out the hard way, you know, about that being trustworthy.
Oh, but the thing is that people can take your idea and change it slightly, change the character, change the location, change just one little thing about your story, and it's not your story anymore. You have to prove
right.
They have taken a majority of your story in order to make claims.
Yeah.
And you
and
have to have
expensive.
A paper trail.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's also expensive to try and
very
file a lawsuit.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very expensive, time-consuming. I mean, I'm the advocate for justice while you're the advocate for forensic nurses. But I can tell you that, you know, you better have energy, and you better have motivation, and you better have your facts together and your information, like you said, just like a forensic nurse, and you better have the time.
And a paper trail
that
you can prove what time did you send this to, and when did they start developing their story, you know.
Yeah, I keep all my emails. I keep all of them.
Yeah.
I print them out and keep them in a folder,
you
know, because emails are legal. You can use emails in a courtroom.
Absolutely.
So I keep all of them. Yeah, and I suggest that to people, you know. I'm not advising anybody, just suggesting that it's a good idea to keep copies of everything, even if you think it's not important.
Right, exactly.
You know, if you were accused of murder, that email may help you out, right?
Oh, absolutely. You never know. Give you an alibi.
Right away. Delete it.
Yeah.
So tell us more about I read that that you noted yourself that it was originally published in 1990 from Leisure Books as Deceptive Desires.
And Leisure Books went under, I think, in 2000. I don't remember when they went bankrupt, but they stopped publishing, and I got the rights back, and then A&K Publishers decided to reprint it because it was a very popular story.
Oh, that's cool, because I just upgraded a book, too, so and from 2013 to what's happening today, and so I'm really excited about that. And
another thing, when you're writing, you've got to be careful about, unless you specifically want to set your story in a certain time period, you have to be careful about making references to, say, President Trump or something like that, you know, because that labels what time period you're looking at. If you don't want people to say, well, this is too old, I don't want to look at it, you know.
Yeah. In my case, it was that things had changed so much and accelerated, so it gave me another story.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
So how does one create a suspense or a romance, because you are the expert in that?
Well, first of all, the suspense and the romance are two separate plots that you have to intertwine and make sure you have to decide, are you writing a suspense romance? Are you writing a romantic suspense? So which is going to be priority? And that's going to be the heavier of the plotting. And you're going to and if you're writing romantic suspense, you know, you'll have the romance elements coming first, and the meeting and the obstacles between them, and then you'll sprinkle that in with a little bit of the suspense, with suspicion about a murder or suspicion about a theft or something like that, and clues, so that the heroine might suspect the man that she loves. But then if you're doing a suspense romance, obviously the romance comes second, and you're going to be trying to solve the crime first and looking at that, and those are the main beats you're going to have in the story, and you'll interweave that with the subplot of the romance. You have to decide. It's very difficult to balance and have something that is both at the same time. So you have to decide which is the first part of your story, which is the more important for you. And in today's market, you have to look at who your audience is. Are you selling mainly to women who want to read romance novels, or are you selling to men who like action novels and suspense? So again, you have to look at who your audience is, who the publisher is that you're writing for, and then gear your story that way. And mm-hmm. each story has its own trope, has its own things that want to appear in certain order, and you have to understand structure of the story and how it goes forward.
Right, and you just can't just decide that this is the way it is. You really have to, sit down and really figure out, right?
That's why I'm able to do more than one story at a time, because I outline mm-hmm. everything, and I can be working on an outline for one, a couple chapters on another, and finishing up the other one, or doing research on a third,
So
that I don't get bored. I don't have writer's block, and I don't get bored with one. If I come to a halt in one, I go to the other one.
Yeah, you sound like me. I have like three on the shelf. Because
right.
You do get, I've had enough of that one for now.
You can be living with a book for 3 or 4 years, maybe longer. I mean, I've had books that have taken 21 submissions before it was finally accepted. And it wasn't because the writing was bad. It was because it wasn't the right time period, because like with Gothics, they decided not to buy Gothics right now. And then finally I changed one of my Gothics, Shrieking Shadows of Penforth Island, and I put sex in it. And they hadn't had much sex in Gothics until then. I made them a married couple. And how are you going to make your story different to make it stand out?
Right, and yeah, because there's so many writers, all over the world, who are all competing.
Exactly.
To stand out. So you have to figure out, are you going to copy somebody, or are you going to be your own person and figure out your own niche,
Right.
I think.
Well, I'm part of a group called RoadmapWriters.com, headed by Joey Tuccio, and it's a wonderful group that helps writers get representation and meet with execs. But as he reminded us, even though we can all be friends, we are all competing against each other for the attention of that one exec, because they can only buy one at a time usually, or maybe a couple of times, but they're not going to buy, all 20 of us at the same time. So you have to realize that as much as you want to be friends with people, you are still competing with them, and you have to make it different and unique.
Right, and that's it's the same with actors and actresses. That's why some stand out and you remember them, and others you don't remember. And then also it's timing, because
definitely.
I didn't really pay much attention to Columbo when he was. He was in character for years in movies.
Right.
And then when he got that TV series, everybody knew who he was, and he became extremely popular. So timing has a lot to do with, but he paid his dues along the way, because he was working in movies, but he wasn't the key star in the movies.
Right, exactly. And he was developing himself.
Then he got the break, and he was totally successful. So it doesn't always come when you're young or immediately, right? Sometimes it takes
time.
You
persistent.
Have to pay your dues.
And if one thing doesn't work, you switch to another for a while and let that one rest. And you have to do your homework, and you have to be reading the trades and know what's selling and what people are looking for. Again, that's why my group, my roadmapwriters.com, which is an internet group, And it's really a wonderful group for helping writers, as I said, get representation and meet execs and so forth and develop their pitch. God, pitching is so important and so difficult. Even for people that are established writers like myself, I hate pitching. I'm not good at it. It's really difficult.
It's not easy.
No. You have to be able to get the story in one or two sentences at the most. And very
few
people
can do that well. Yeah, I took a class with Gail Murphy. You know who Gail Murphy is.
Yeah.
She teaches pitching, and she's written the book on pitching. And I took her workshop, and it's not easy. And then I had to sit before a producer. I didn't have to. I mean, he invited me because he wanted my memoir after reading my first book. And, of course, I didn't have it ready. But so he wanted to meet me, so I met with him at the studio, and it's a few years ago, and then he was super interested, and he, you know, when it came to the pitch, my mind went blank. I froze.
Right.
He told me my pitch.
And then
unfortunately, he got sued for sexual harassment, so that didn't happen. But,
oh, my God.
Yeah. That's
how you don't deal with him.
Yeah, it was bad timing. But, it was interesting, but it was a good experience because I was sitting before a real producer who could have made it happen if the lawsuit hadn't come along. But when the pitch came, even though I took the workshop, my mind went blank. I froze.
Right. That's why you want to write your pitch out beforehand and try and memorize it as much as possible, but then you have to be able to make it natural while you're talking, you know, and not go word for word and not read it off the paper. Reading it off the paper when you're pitching is death.
Hold on. Let me get my card out.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, yeah. But that was an exciting time, though.
That was exciting. So tell me... How do you actually find at what you think is an important thing in the plotting?
First of all, my motto is to educate while entertaining. So I look at what needs to be done in the world, and then I try to write a story around that in some way, shape, or form. What's most important is who the characters are, what they want, how badly do they want, what are they willing to do to get it, and who is fighting against them and what they are willing to do. And most times, the antagonist is more interesting than the main character because you've given him more depth. So you have to give your main character just as much depth as you give the antagonist. You have to do a bio on them. You have to understand them. And a lot of that will not show up in the actual writing, but it will show up as you are writing because you will understand your character and what decisions they make.
That's important.
You know, yes, I mean, I write historicals, I write westerns, I write young adult, I write supernatural stuff, but it's who the characters are that make the difference. And especially if you're writing TV. TV wants the characters that people will come back and watch week after week after week.
Yeah, like some of those ones that Netflix puts out on the series, you know. I mean, if you start watching some of them, they're so well put together and the characters are so good. I've sat through the whole thing. I mean, it's terrible. I'm like, oh, I can't find out what the next episode is. You know, a whole day just watching the whole series. I'm like, this is awful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the idea. That's what they want. That is what they want, you know. So, I mean, but you have to understand who your characters are.
Yeah, because I was trying to point out exactly what you said, is that those characters are so important because you can get hooked and as if they're part of your life.
Mm-hmm. Yes. my brother used to say that all my characters, all my heroines were part of me in some way. But one problem that most new writers have is they describe their characters in terms of physical terms, blonde hair, blue eyes, beautiful. The fact is, that doesn't matter. What matters is their actions. And he bent down and gave water to the poor kitten. you know. And he dropped money in the homeless bucket, you know. Or he kicked the homeless man, you know.
God.
Actions are more important and tell us more about the character than it does, you know, that he wore, a Chanel dress.
Okay.
See, you have to understand who the character is and what they want, what their obstacles are, really well before you start writing. And most people don't. A lot of people are pantsers, and they don't like to outline. But you really do have to outline. It helps you to know where you're going.
Oh yeah, I mean, it can get really confusing otherwise.
You can get caught in the middle. With a murder, and suddenly you're holding the knife in the murder, and it's not, you know, and that's not what you intended in the story.
Right. That's so true. And so what got you interested in that particular time period with your book?
Well, for Logan's Land, or Deceptive Desire, the earlier version, I've been doing research about early Montana because I was doing a historical. I was out there doing autographing for some of my other books, and I found out about the robber barons and about taking over the land and the start of the FBI. The Treasury Division was started then, and they were the ones that became the FBI through Teddy Roosevelt. I thought, oh, that's interesting, and I decided to create a story around that. You know.
Yes. You know what's interesting that you said is that what I find is, like, I have totally changed a book from the original. I was redoing it, and from the original draft, because I started doing some research on some couple of minor things that led to something else. And then it was something else, and I'm like, wow, that's really even more interesting. And so
absolutely.
Research, yeah, mm-hmm. Research can change your book.
Mm-hmm. And the small,
I mean, not totally,
thing,
but
when you're researching, say, oh, my God, that's a perfect line for the research, you know.
Yeah, I'm a researcher. I love to research.
I do, too, but you can get caught up in doing too much research and not do the writing.
I know, because it's like, oh, my God, look at this and look at that. And then before you know it, the hours are gone.
And I don't have enough material yet. In fact, if you do, because it's all in your head, and if you start writing, it'll start flowing, but you're scared to get it out there. So you can't be scared. You just got to let it flow and write what I call the first vomit draft. And your first draft is usually not the best one, but you got it out, you got the story out, and then you can mold it and fix it and do what you want with it.
That's so true. It is so true. I mean, even writing just a short article, you read it again and again and again, and you could improve it. Doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You can improve it. Yeah. So how many books have you written, and what is your favorite genre?
I've lost exactly count. I write in almost every genre except guts and gore horror. I think I have around 39 or 40 books published, including some that were published overseas and stuff like that aren't even here. But, but the fact is I don't get money from each one all the time. You get a certain amount. You used to get royalty up front. Now it's very rare that we get royalty unless you're with a huge publisher. And the royalty statements are very rare, but they come only every 6 months, and it's not something that an average person cannot really live as on being a writer, unless you are really, really super successful. So you do have to have another job, at least starting out, until you hit the best-selling list.
And then what happens when you hit the best-selling list?
Well, then you have the money, and then you might have money coming in on a regular basis because they're doing paperback and they're doing audiobook and they're doing movie deals and stuff like that. But not mm-hmm. always. Not always.
Yeah.
You've got to, you still have to have a backup. You really still have to have a backup.
Because it's all, you don't know if a producer's going to buy your book or not.
Right. No, you don't.
Or to the movie. No, you don't know. It's like throwing the dice in Vegas, you know, how much you're going to bet.
Right.
So it goes back to being persistent and consistent, like you said.
Believing in yourself, deciding,
believing in what you love to do.
Yes, and deciding what is important to you. Like when I was working full-time, instead of going out to party and having drinks after work, I'd go home and write. Instead of, you know, I would take my lunch and gobble down my lunch, and the next 45 minutes, I'd be writing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So have to decide what's important to you. Do you want to socialize and be popular at work, you know, or do you want to, you know, be a successful writer? And you have to be determined and be persistent and go and reread your stuff and go forward.
Yeah, you have to believe in yourself, I think, too, you know. Yeah, I think so. I mean, even if you're afraid to put it out there, you know, because it is your name on there and you did write it. sometimes it's scary for people, isn't it? To do that,
it is.
To take that first step.
It is. Yeah. Very, very difficult. Can be, yeah. Yeah.
Especially
yeah.
if you're writing a memoir, because you're actually you're exposing yourself, and you're also maybe exposing other people, like family or friends, and so you got I think that's more where you really have to stop and think, you know, what am I going to put into this book, because
right.
I don't want to, you know, upset somebody else.
Right, exactly. I remember one of my books, my Unborn Witness about Domestic Violence, my brother said, you better not mention anything about Daddy, you know. and so I had to wait to publish it until my father was dead, because my brother would have been very angry with me, you know, if I had mentioned something about our father. So you have to decide, you know, what's worth it, what's going on, you know, for family and stuff like that.
Yeah, because it's not just affecting, usually it's not affecting just the person, because our memoirs involve other people.
Exactly,
so,
they do. Absolutely,
yeah.
They do. Absolutely,
so what's
they do.
The best way, would you say, for someone who wants to get started in writing, or maybe have something, a draft, and thinking about it?
Well, first of all, you have to read a lot, and you have to decide whether you're writing scripts, or whether you're writing books. Read in the genre that you want to write in, because you'll see certain tropes, certain things that happen in, say, in the romance genre, or in the horror genre, or in the Western genre, that you need to include in your story, and you'll get a sense of pacing. So you have to be reading a lot. And then you decide what's important to you. What do you want to write about? You know, who are your characters, and what do they want? And why do they want it? Again, developing the characters is the most important thing, you know, for your storylines.
Yeah, and I find developing the characters are the most fun for me, because I like being able to make them do whatever I want or say whatever
right.
I want. You know,
you don't want to do that. You have to do what they want. When I was writing Red Sea, Dead Sea, the grandmother mystery series from St. Martin's Press, my partner and I would, if we had a problem with our character, we would meet with her therapist, and each would argue Fanny's viewpoint. And whoever had the best viewpoint for Fanny, our character, would win and write that part of the story. Because you have to, what's
cool.
consistent with who the character is. I mean, it's not going to, if she's shy and she's awkward, she's not going to be jumping over a rooftop. You have to show that you've got some athletic ability. You have to do setup and payoff, and you have to understand where your character is coming from and what makes sense for her. You know, if she's afraid of water, why is she afraid of water? And then you have to make it clear that she's going to jump in the water to save her aunt or something like that. You know what I'm saying? You have to have a good reason for them doing something.
Absolutely. That's a really good point and excellent tips for our audience and for all of us. And so we have to remember that. And that's really good. And so it's, do you think it's easy to switch from novels to scripts?
Okay, well, you need a good story for both. But there's different rules for script writing than for novel writing. Script writing is a lot shorter. These days, a good script is anywhere between 90 and 110 pages. And it's hard to get a whole big story from a book into that. Like, I'm adapting the Dracula book right now, and I'm having to eliminate certain scenes. I'm having to combine certain characters, things like that. Also, scripts are in present tense, and everything has to be visual. You don't want to be having anything that is thoughts of the characters. Everything has to be able to be shown on screen. Whereas in the novel, you can get into the character's head, you can get into the antagonist's head, you can do extensive descriptions about the scenery and stuff like that. But in a script, for instance, you have one or two lines describing the scene because the scene designer is who's going to make the scheme. You know, so
and
you have to
you
understand who's doing what in scripts, you know, and who's doing what in your book.
So would
and
you say
scripts,
going from the novel? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. As
would
said,
you say
in,
going
in
from
scripts,
the
you
novel?
You have to deal with not only yourself, but your agent and the director and the actor and everybody's going and the producer and everybody's gonna have comments. Whereas in a novel, maybe your editor will have comments.
Yeah, that's a biggie. And then also, would you say that going from the novel to the script is more action in the script than
absolutely
thought.
You have to be careful of having too many talking heads in your script.
Mm.
Too many scenes where they're just sitting there talking and explaining things. You don't want to do that. You want to have action while they're explaining things.
Yeah. Okay. And then I'm just so excited about all your information. Now that we're coming to the end of the interview, what's up the pipeline for you?
Well, as I said, I'm doing the adaptation of the Dracula story. I have a couple of historicals. Historicals are starting to come back as miniseries. Networks are investing in that, so I have a couple of historicals that I'm working on as pilots and maybe a feature. And so I'm working on that as well. I'm also working on a NASCAR story that my late partner, his family, was one of the originators of the NASCAR down in South Carolina. So I'm doing that from a female viewpoint again and making changes so that it's different than ordinary NASCAR stories. I'm keeping my eye out for other things coming up.
And so do you have any tips on the best genres to be looking at for 2023, let's say?
Well, horror is always a good seller, and thrillers and mysteries are always selling well. I think rom-com is starting to come back, but you have to be aware comedy doesn't sell well overseas because they have a different humor standard than we do, and most of the money comes from overseas. So it has to be something that's really funny and has to really or be really low budget, something that they don't have to worry about getting too much money from overseas. So you have to look at what you're writing. And again, reading the trades will give you an idea of what is now. And then you have to try and predict what's coming in the future because they're not going to tell you what's coming in the future. You have to look at what's being bought now. And by the time you finish writing it, they might not be buying that anymore. Although, as I said, thrillers and mysteries and horror are almost always going to be avoided, especially horrors are usually very low budget.
Oh, yeah, and then there's the budget.
Yeah, the budget. You have to worry. Yeah, I mean, like when you – oh, that's another thing. When you're writing scripts, you want to be careful of having too many crowd scenes, too many with too many people and too many busy. God, look how many characters you have. Whereas in a book, you can have as many crowd scenes, as many characters as you want.
Right. There's a lot more that goes into it than meets the eye, right?
Yeah, yeah. It definitely is, yes. But, you know, it's a matter of keeping up with what's going on in the industry.
Yeah, and I think, too, though, it's also a matter of passion and love for writing and telling stories and creating stories and finding joy in that. And I think that, that's part
exactly.
of the reward, right?
Exactly. And you know, you're going to be living with that story for a long time because you might be rewriting it 3 or 4 times, maybe more, sending it out more times, and you have to, it has to be a story that you really like and enjoy and you really want to write.
Yeah. So, Sarita Stevens, now is your time to shine now that we've come to the end of our wonderful interview. And you can tell our audience any message you want or if you have any contact
information. Okay, well, people
can
look on Amazon for some of my books, Sarita D. Stevens. And my website is saritastevens.com. And I'm always happy to answer questions. And as a forensic nurse, I help others with their medical poison and forensic questions for their stories. So I'm always happy to help people with that.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Sarita Stevens. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And thank you for all the wealth of information you provide to the audience. And we'll talk to
you
again.
Thank you. I'll talk to you again soon.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And Sarita Stevens has left the building. And again, that is Sarita, S-E-R-I-T-A, and Stevens, S-T-E-V, like Victor, E-N-S. Sarita Stevens, and look her up on Amazon.com because you will find a long list of wonderful stories that you can read and enjoy and learn from. It's best to learn and read from the experts. And on that note, we're going to enter into the world of authors, not authors and experts, but the Justice Club. So don't touch that dial. We'll be back in just a moment.
Obamasaurus, the new book by Rose M. Colombo, is an updated version of a political satire that reflects the political roadmap of today's world. Written with an Orwellian twist, will humanity survive or suffer depopulation or extinction? Obamasaurus by Rose M. Colombo, available at Amazon.com.
The Justice Club is back on Colombo Chronicles live podcast. Join Rose Colombo at noon and find out what tips she will provide in a world of little justice.
Colombo Chronicles Live. Colombo is on their trail. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live.
That's right. Listen up at Colombo Chronicles Live because our tip on the Justice Club today, chosen from Fox News, it's very important for the entire world and Western civilization, and especially America right now, with the open border crisis. House Republicans sound alarm over report Venezuela, the communist leader, is sending violent criminals to the United States borders. There has been an increase in Venezuelans, Nicaraguans, and Cubans coming to the border, and many of them have been released from prison as felons, dangerous criminals, and especially from Venezuela, who just emptied out their prisons, sending their most dangerous to the Mexico-U.S. borders, where we're already over inundated with cartels, gangs, smugglers, fentanyl coming from China, illegal drugs, traffickers of human organs, traffickers of females and children, and trespassing on U.S. soil through illegal entry called legal by the left for many decades now. Exclusive House Republicans are sounding the alarm over a reported move by Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro to empty prisons of violent criminals and send them empty. I want you to hear the word empty their prisons. So they don't have to support their prisoners anymore, and they don't have to deal with them on their streets and release them in Venezuela. They're sending them to our civilized nation, which is a republic operated by the rule of law that hasn't been a republic operated by the rule of law or a sovereign nation since 1993, when the Democrats opened up the borders. And even prior to that, President Bush supported the North American Union to open the borders through the CFR, who proposed the North American Union open borders policy. And they have been pushing that ever since. So the article says, we write you with serious concern about a recent United States Department of Homeland Security, DHS, intelligence report received by Border Patrol that instructs agents to look for violent criminals from Venezuela among the migrant caravans heading towards the United States-Mexico border. The letter by 14 House Republicans led by Representative Troy Nels, a Republican in Texas. Now, this is going to truly affect Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California. We're already, we have, oh, about 2020, before Facebook exiled me in 2021, I posted that I didn't believe that there were only 12 million illegals in our country, because they've been saying that since Clinton was in office. I thought there was more like 30 million. So I posted that on Facebook. And then Stanford University, shortly thereafter, posted that their statistics proved that there are 29.5 million illegals inside the USA living off of welfare and SCAN and probably Social Security, Medicare, Obamacare. And this is why your taxes, our taxes, are skyrocketing to pay for more than 30 million, because since that time, since 2020, there has been millions more coming into the USA through the open borders, because the people in public office refuse to uphold their sworn oath, which is to secure the borders and uphold the Constitution, which requires secure borders and requires legal vetting and background checks and searches, and requires legal citizenship, requires assimilation if you do become a legal citizen, and requires legal driver licenses and insurance, and requires legal voting rights, which belong to the natural-born Americans first, and then to the naturalized legal Americans second, and never to the illegals in who violated our laws and illegally entered and bypassed all those who have been waiting in line for years to become American citizens, proud American citizens legally, and to uphold, defend, protect the United States Constitution, our secure borders, and our sovereignty of this great republic. Because guess what? We don't have a country without secure borders. We are not a sovereign country without secure borders. We are not a sovereignty at all, and we are not a republic operated by the rule of law when top down in our government, they refuse to secure our borders, for which we pay taxes to all law enforcement, Department of Justices, all elected officials, all appointed officials in the Department of Justice, especially in law enforcement, Border Patrol, ICE, and sheriffs and police and TSA and Customs, to protect us from illegal entry. Why are we paying taxes for that if they aren't going to provide that protection and uphold the Constitution that requires them
which they swore to do, to protect the welfare and safety of every legal American citizen inside the USA. Why are we bothering to even have a Department of Justice? Because if they are going to have their hands tied by the executive office, who now bypasses Congress, bypasses the Constitution and the duties of law enforcers, and protects and harbors and aids the illegals, who many are jihadists, terrorists, spies, criminals, felons, traffickers, smugglers, coming into the USA, come to harm our citizens and steal our land and possibly conquer our land through overpopulation, which is a stated and strategic goal of the Muslim Brotherhood strategies and also the communist written and stated strategies. And how do they do that? Through a lawless nation that no longer is a republic, is no longer a sovereign nation, is no longer a republic, because the leaders in this country refuse to follow the United States Constitution, ignore it, trample on it. They rewrite it illegally. They alter it illegally. They pass unread laws now, like Obamacare, 2,700 pages of death panels, euthanasia, mandated taxpayer-funded worldwide vaccines, mandated taxpayer-funded worldwide abortions, and early end-of-life counseling, and implementing a 90-day EUA emergency use authorization through the FDA and HHS and CDC and WHO and NIH to jab millions of Americans with an unknown formula created by Pfizer and mRNA never used on human beings. And after two jabs killed all the test animals, so they went directly to using human lab rats, which are you and me. And now the babies, and another baby just died today after being jabbed with those experimental and trial injections. How many more are going to die in the future, and how many more Americans are going to be have their homes invaded and illegals, criminals trespassing on their property, and how many more do we have to watch the government use our taxes to aid and abet and harbor and fund illegals inside the United States of America, while the American people's food, gasoline, electricity, housing, rent, mortgages are becoming unaffordable. Well, that's all we have time for on the Justice Club, and I just want to say God bless you. God bless America. And remember, injustices can happen to you, and they can happen to me. But together, we can make a positive difference. Remember, you are never alone when you tune in to Colombo Chronicles Live.
Well, my friends, time flies, and now is the time to say goodbye. Thanks so much for being part of the Colombo Chronicles family. You are appreciated. Please do it now. Bookmark. Push that like, share, and follow button. Oh, and don't forget to comment below and stay in touch. Make your family part of the Colombo family. Until next Wednesday at noon, remember, God loves you, and so does the Rose.